Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello, and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and today I'm joined by Dr. John Fredrickson, who is an author, psychotherapist, and founder of the Intensive Short-Term Dynamic Psychotherapy Institute at Washington, D.C. In this episode, we'll be talking about his approach to psychotherapy and how he helps people to understand themselves better and get out of their own way. John is a seasoned practitioner with a career spanning decades that includes providing intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy training workshops, supervision groups, and enlightening conferences in the United States and Europe. His vast experience also includes pivotal roles at the Washington School of Psychiatry since 1988, where he has served as chair of various advanced training programs. John is also an author of several popular books on psychotherapy, including Psychodynamic Psychotherapy, Co-Creating Change, The Lies We Tell Ourselves, and his most recent book, Healing Through Relating, published in 2023. In a perhaps unconventional route to becoming a psychotherapist, John was previously a professional musician and has often drawn parallels between how musicians hone their skills and how therapists develop their practice. So I'm sure that we will be in for a fascinating discussion in this episode. Welcome to the show, John. How are you?
Fine, thanks. And thanks for inviting me.
From musicians to psychotherapists, are you playing your clients like you play the French horn?
Well, no, that would be impossible, of course. But in fact, in music, it requires a great attention to listening. And when you're a musician, you not only listen to the melody, you listen to all the harmony lines, you listen to the bass line. We have this thing called counterpoint. Many people here have heard of a fugue, right? Where you might have a melody playing in four different voices at different times, creating very complex interplays. So as a musician, you're already trained to listen on multiple levels at the same time. And you're also taught about how to be in tune with other people. You're taught about how to be in rhythm so that your rhythm matches the other people. You're taught how to be in the same tempo as other people so that you're not rushing when someone else is slower or slowing down when other people are rushing. You learn really this idea of what we call ensemble and playing together. And really, it's a way of being together. And so as therapists, these same principles apply because we have to listen on multiple levels. Just to give you an idea of what that looks like, let's suppose that you're with a patient and a patient said, you know, I'm thinking of going to art school. And then the patient says, I'm thinking of going to art school. Do you think that's a good idea? Now, persons who listen to manifest content, the ordinary person on the street would say, sure, it sounds like a great idea, right? They would, and that would be how they would listen. But a therapist would then listen other ways. The therapist would be thinking, therapists who might listen to the sequence of what the patient says, or what we call process, that therapist might say, well, I notice you're asking for my opinion now, but a moment ago, you were freer to express your own. I wonder if something felt risky about expressing your own wish to go to art school. Because then that therapist would be curious, huh, he's inviting me to bring my opinion in, which would inhibit him from elaborating on his own ambition. Another therapist might have heard that the patient's parents disapproved. So then this therapist might be thinking, huh, so this patient is reporting his wish to go to art school. Maybe he's afraid I would judge him, and that's why he's checking in to see whether I approve of his point of view. Maybe he's afraid I'll be another judgmental person. Another person listening might hear the patient say, so what do you think I should do? And the therapist would note, wow, I am really tempted to tell this patient what to do. But if
So
I
many
tell this
different
patient what to
channels,
do,
right?
if I tell this patient what to do, I'd be sort of taking up a one-up position, as if I'm the authority knows best and he knows less. And now, to come to think of it, this guy tends to take a one-down position in relationships. So I better not answer this question, otherwise I'll be enacting this relational pattern he gets into. So this gives you an idea that we could listen and just answer the question. We could see the sequence. We could see how I might symbolize another person. We could see how we'd be invited to an enactment. And it gives you a sense then, as a therapist, that you might listen to what we call manifest content. You might listen to process. You might listen to latent content. You might listen to enactment. And then we could get into
Right.
listening to countertransference. But it gives you an idea that everybody knows how to listen in a certain way, but really listening as a therapist is actually much more complex, just like a musician can listen in a much more complex way to music.
You know, John, I mean, while you were talking, it reminded me of myself as a young grad student learning psychotherapy, and it can't help but to change you, but then I became extremely annoying to my friends and family because of all these channels I was listening to. I couldn't stop myself, you
Yeah.
know, and obviously you're describing it because you train so much from it, there's a lot of practice of it. So how do you, is there, you know, do you stop yourself from listening and analyzing all the time with other people, or is it always going on, but you just, you know, you don't say it?
Well, obviously I like to relax when I'm with friends, so I'm not trying to listen to latent content, for example. We're just enjoying ourselves. We're having it fun. Now, sometimes people, a friend will say something, and I'll think to myself, oh, I can hear this conflict my friend has. I'm not going to be his therapist, but the way I listen or way I might respond will reflect my understanding. Obviously, I'm not there to do therapy on any family member or friend. That's my not job. But it allows me to understand my friends more deeply. It allows me to be more empathic. I cert you know they don't ask for my analysis, of course, and I'm not here to offer it, but it allows me to hear them more deeply and be more sensitive. It allows me, in fact, as a therapist, then it allows me more sensitive. You know, oftentimes friends think that they should be giving advice or telling friends what to do. And as a therapist, I almost never would give in to that because of all the things that I could see how it would not help my friends. So I think, in a way, being a really good therapist can actually help you be a better listener for your friends and actually help you be a better friend without conducting therapy with them, which, of course, they didn't ask you to do.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point that I often tell people, like, you know, it's yes, it's part of me and it's one of my skills, but it's also a job, right? And I'm, when I'm relaxing, I don't want to be analyzing. Something that I think it took me a while to learn how to almost switch off that sensitivity and say, okay, you know, like mind, like you're not here, that's not your role, and that's, you know, that's a hat that you can actually take off, even though, yes, it has
Yeah.
influenced the way you're listening, as you've described.
Yeah, you can take your therapist hat off and then put your friend hat on.
Yeah, like
But
it's
the fact
interesting to think
is,
about that. It took me a while to just be human again. You know, like I swung
yeah.
to one side and I had to like learn how to be like just regular suck again.
Right. Well, I think too, really good listening and training as a therapist helps you not only be more human, and in a sense that you really learn not to judge anyone for their difficulties. You learn to really accept whatever the patient brings, because they're bringing you whatever needs to be helped. And it also helps you realize, as Harry Sack Sullivan is said, we're all much more human than otherwise, right? So everyone is struggling with the problems of living, and we're always trying to understand why would that make sense? Like today I was supervising someone, and he was a bit upset with this patient really not revealing her feelings, and was wondering how to work with that, and was feeling irritated with her. And then, of course, as he tells the woman's history, it turns out this patient had a very violent alcoholic father. And I said, is it possible that this woman learned that if she shared feelings, that it might be the trigger to violence? And so when she was threatening to leave, let's think about that. Because in a sense, when she's threatening to leave therapy, you want to understand what was the danger. And she was afraid, if I reveal these feelings, you, the therapist, might be violent with me. And so I should leave the therapy office to stop that violence from happening. So if we can talk about her wish to reveal herself, the fear of violence, and then the defense of wanting to leave the session, suddenly her plight becomes understandable. And it's a very human reaction to want to leave the room. As I was saying to him, a lot of times the reaction a patient has on the surface looks very illogical. But we're always trying to figure out what are the unconscious reasons that reveal the unconscious logic that makes us all very understandable. And so in that way, we're always interested, no matter what the patient's behavior is, our basic assumption is there must be a good reason for this. This Right. must make sense in some way. So our job is to figure out, why does that make perfect sense? Why is this perfectly understandable?
Do you believe that there's absolute truth to understanding? Or are we just coming up with, you know, our subjective understanding, right, of the patient's behavior and why they may have behaved that way? Or are we trying to uncover, okay, objectively, you know, like, why really is she doing that?
Well, of course, you're touching on the whole issue of epistemology, right? And there's all kinds of theories about truth and so on and so forth. But there's an interesting way we can approach this. I mean, therapy is not a place where you just make stuff up, right? They're kind of, it's like in law, there are rules of evidence. So like earlier, we were talking about a therapist who heard about a patient, and the therapist, this teacher said, well, this is all about the breast. It's like, what?
But for the sake of the listeners, I was telling John about a supervisor who was observing a case, and all of a sudden he proclaimed it's all about a breast, which threw me off guard as a young therapist. And I was like, what on earth is going on, right?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, we have, in a case like that, we have no evidence about what happened during the patient's breastfeeding stage, right? It's a way to make stuff up. It sounds like an oracle spoke, you know, so it's kind of crazy. It's like the oracle has spoken. Wow, how did the oracle know what happened at 3 months of age? Well, the fact is the oracle didn't. How would anyone know that? Right. So there, although people oftentimes make stuff up and they make it up in very impressive tones, they're still making stuff up. But patients don't get better just because we make stuff up. They get better because they feel understood. And so oftentimes what we're looking for when we intervene or when we offer a comment, we listen to how the patient responds. Does the patient feel understood? Does what we say, do we see a drop in symptoms? Do we see the patient having an increased freedom, right? Do we see something relax in some way, right? And so we're really looking at patient responses to our interventions. And then we look to see, did the patient's response validate my intervention? Or does the patient's response let me know I was off track? So in that way, there really is kind of an empirical way we listen to patient responses. Because in an interesting way, see, patients' responses are actually giving us the supervision. Patients' responses supervise us. They let us know that helped, that didn't help. And so a lot of times what happens in supervision, as I tell my supervisees, I'm not your real supervisor. I'm actually teaching you to listen to the real supervisor, who's your patient. So let's listen to the supervision your patient's giving us. And so a lot of it is learning to read what kind of supervision is the patient giving. For example, you know, a therapist could make some grand interpretation, and afterwards the patient talks about an uncle who's hard of hearing and people just get tired of listening to him, okay? And the latent content, the patient's saying, you are hard of hearing and I'm tired of listening to you. And that lets you know, wow, my interpretation definitely didn't work. Whereas if your intervention really was very helpful, the patient may start talking about a family member who was a good listener and was really helpful when they were trying to leave home, right? So you would have a very positive image, which lets you know on an unconscious level, the patient found your intervention helpful. And there are, of course, many other things we look at in terms of confirmation, but it's very important when we look at truth, it's really, we're always evaluating these responses to let us know, am I on the right track? Am I not on the right track? And learning to listen to that supervision. So the patient, because in a sense, the patient is always teaching us actually how to do therapy with them.
It sounds very collaborative. I was under the impression, and please correct me, but that maybe old school psychodynamic or psychoanalytic traditions came more from I'm an expert and I'm informing, or sort of that I'm proclaiming this is what's happening to you, you know. But right now you're describing, you know, a practice that's a lot more collaborative, a lot more listening to the how the client's responding.
There have always been very collaborative therapists, and there's always been narcissists. When you think about it, I mean, therapists, you have the bell curve of humanity doing therapy as therapists, right? And so there's always collaborative therapists, and there's always been narcissists.
I guess my question is, you know, was it ever the tradition of we are proclaiming, or was it always a tradition that we are actually collaborating?
I think there's always been a mixed picture, even in psychoanalysis. You know, Freud was listening to see whether his interventions are being validated or not. Certainly his daughter, the same is true. Ferenczi, yeah. And at the same time, you had other people that, you know, I know best, this is the way it is. So, you know, it's not uncommon for therapists to be narcissistic, and it's certainly not uncommon for narcissism to not get looked at in therapy. So, I mean, I'm sure you don't have to look far to think of therapists you've known who are a bit narcissistic. So I think the problem is that in psychotherapy, the basic state of psychotherapy training right now is really quite poor. 20% of therapists are getting 80% of the good results in therapy. 38% of therapists are consistently unhelpful. And there was a study, they asked therapists, where would you rank yourself from 0 to 100? And the average therapist ranked themselves in the 80th percentile. And no therapist ranked themselves below the 75th percentile. Mm-hmm. Now, you might think, okay, well, maybe narcissists are uniquely narcissistic, right? Therapists are uniquely narcissistic. Turns out they've tried this with other fields. Doctors think the same way. It's just...
We're all there. We
overestimate really how good we are. But the problem in our field is that the part of the research we have is that on average, graduate school education doesn't make therapists more effective. And on average, therapists don't become better during their career. And something very sobering, 93% of supervision is inadequate and 35% is harmful. So unfortunately, a lot of therapists aren't really trained systematically in how to be collaborative as therapists. And I'm sure in your experience teaching, you're doing a lot of what I would call rehabilitation work. You're teaching therapists
correcting practices,
how to be collaborative. Yeah, they have practices, and they've been used to just lecturing, talking at patients, and you're actually having to teach them how to listen, how to be collaborative, how to receive feedback from patients, and how to read feedback. But I think the problem is not so much the field, but that our training as therapists, I think oftentimes is really quite inadequate and failing to really instill this idea of collaboration and how we measure it and how to take feedback.
Why do you think that's so? Like, how did our field have such poor training?
I think there's a couple of things. One thing is that I think it's kind of started with psychoanalysis. I think psychoanalysis, many aspired to be like a science. So they tended to emphasize theory a lot and get into abstract theory to make it seem like something really great. But when they got emphasized theory, they forgot about how does this apply to practice? And in education theory, this is known as they were emphasizing declarative knowledge, which are the facts and theories and concepts, but they failed to show how declarative knowledge translates into procedural knowledge. What do you actually do in therapy? And so a lot of therapists come out, not really, they might know a theory, they might know CBT theory, or they might know psychoanalytic theory or whatever, but they actually don't necessarily know how do you translate that into practical action. And then the next thing that they're not taught, most therapists, regardless of field, are really not taught how to assess patient responses. Did this patient really validate my response, or did they invalidate it? They're really not taught how to assess patient responses so they could take the feedback, revise their thinking, and then revise their intervention. So I think that's what's happening in our field, is that people tend to teach only theory. And so people can intellectualize about theory and they figure, well, if I can intellectualize about theory, I must be a great therapist. Not. And you have some therapists who are taught some techniques, but they're not really taught how to think about the patient. So they just kind of tend to throw techniques at the patient, and it's like becomes like throwing darts and they hope one of them sticks.
Right. I'm very curious. So one of the things that led me to psychotherapy, so first of all, I was very young and always watching people and love people watching, but also craziness runs in the family. And so very early on, you know, family members were showing symptoms of illness, and which got me interested because in Malaysia, especially even 20, 30 years ago, there was very little help. I mean, right now, today, John, we have about 300 clinical psychologists in a population of 30 million, right? Serving 30 million. Is, you know, some hospitals have no clinic psychs, some only have one. So it's, you know, very young here. So I guess that got me interested in wanting to be in the field. And I came into the field being, I will be the savior, of course. Save everyone. I am
the universal fantasy. Yeah.
And then, you know, as I think your book describes, you know, life got in the way of my fantasies, reality hit. I got depressed and realized I need help. And, you know, so that I think that was, you know, depression for me was transformative in many ways of just shaking up my reality. I wouldn't wish to go through it, but there was a meaningful experience that came out of, you know, those years of being depressed, that, you know, made me think, I'm not coming in from an outside point of view. I'm not coming in a savior to rescue all these people. I'm with them, you know, in the ditch, right? Trying to figure life out. As you said, you know, you quoted Harry Stack Sullivan, you know, that we all have problems in living, right? And I love that quote of him because he doesn't psychopathologize, and in that age, you know, Freud's contemporary, you know, there was a lot of like these sick, ill people, and he dealt with people with schizophrenia. So what brought you into the field? Like, what got you interested in psychotherapy, considering that, you know, one of your first loves were music?
Well, from a very early age, I was quite interested, and similarly, severe issues in my own family that made me quite interested in why does this happen, right? Why do people suffer so profoundly and severely? And of course, there was my own suffering as well. And so I, in high school, I ran across a book by Eric Fromm, a psychoanalyst, and I was just, it was revelatory, right? It was just like a whole world was making sense in new and unusual ways. And I really got interested in psychoanalysis, and I hoped one day I could be a psychoanalyst. The problem was, is my father was a blacksmith, and my parents didn't think I needed to go to college, because the idea was that I would take over my father's blacksmith shop, and I had grown up working in the blacksmith shop. So other kids had a childhood. I worked in his blacksmith shop during the summers and on weekends. So fortunately, at that time, I was very talented at the horn. I was taking horn lessons, and my horn teacher said, "So where are you going to college?" And I says, "Well, my parents are thinking I should just go to this community college for 2 years and take over my dad's blacksmith shop." And he was just horrified. So he called my parents and drove 80 miles to their house and spent an evening having a conversation with them and convinced them that I should go to college to become a musician. So if you ever wonder if a conversation can change a life, yeah, I'm the evidence of it. Fortunately, my parents agreed that I could go to college. And so, in a way, music was my ticket. I wanted to become a psychologist or, psychologist or whatever, but music was really kind of my ticket. And I was getting a scholarship based on my music, which was enabling me to go through school. So that was my ticket. So after I graduated, I became a professional musician. I met my wife. She's also a musician. And so we were both working as professional musicians. And so we thought, wouldn't it be great if we were in the same orchestra? So we would take orchestra auditions. And the National Symphony Orchestra had several auditions, some for oboe, my wife's instrument, and some for horn. And each time they'd hear a couple hundred people come down to 10 semifinalists and two finalists and pick a winner. In those five auditions, either my wife or I made it to the two finalists and they picked the other person.
Oh.
So five times. So I said to my wife, I said, there's no question we could both get into an orchestra, but it doesn't look like it's going to be the same one. So I thought my wife really wanted to be an orchestra. And I knew if she was an orchestra, I didn't want to be a freelancer. So I thought, this is my chance. I can go back to school and become a therapist. So that's what I did. I went back to school. So I'd play the horn at night and go to school during the day to put myself through school. And yeah, and then I'd be was able to fulfill my dream of becoming a therapist.
Now, let me ask you maybe a question. I don't know where you've received this question. Were you ever attracted to CBT? Did you ever wish, man, I wish I studied CBT instead of becoming a psychodynamic therapist?
No,
No.
I was never that attracted to it.
Yeah. And why
I was
not?
never that attracted to it. It seems simplistic, and you have to remember when I was starting out, this is 40 years ago, right? It seemed very simplistic. It was totally cognitive. Emotions were completely ignored, right? This is first wave CBT, right? It's a very different CBT than what we have today. So CBT at that time did not address emotions. So it was very simplistic. It really didn't address a lot of defenses. It didn't address transference, how people relate to you. So what happened in CBT, right? It was a very simplistic model initially. And then over time, sort of second wave of CBT then began to incorporate emotion a bit. Third wave, they incorporated transference, which is called schema therapy. So they don't call it transference, they call it a schema. And then they misunderstood anxiety until really 2017, I think, with Barlow, when they realized we have to incorporate neuroscience and we realize anxiety is not caused by thoughts, it's caused by emotions, with a fear system in the body, right? So the way it was initially wasn't it was not that interesting. Also, another reason is that the research was terrible. The first major research on CBT was done in the United States at NIH, the National Institute of Health. And so they did a massive multi-site study where they were comparing CBT, interpersonal therapy, and something called humanistic therapy. So interpersonal therapy helped 49% of the patients. CBT helped 50% of the patients. So then it was the winner. And so then it was like CBT is this very helpful treatment. And it was for a very, very simple disorder. I think it was called dysthymic mood disorder at the time. It's not a diagnosis that exists anymore. But 2 years later, they did a follow-up study. And it turned out that between the three sites, between 77 and 88% of the CBT patients relapsed. So at that time, CBT looked like it was effective, but it had a massive relapse problem. So that was another reason that I wasn't interested at that time because it was just there was a serious problem with relapse. Of course, over time, it's become a very popular treatment for many things, but they still have a relapse problem. The reason I like dynamic therapy is a lot of reasons, but one of them is that we see that when patients terminate therapy, it's a very low rate of relapse. But what's unique about psychodynamic therapies is that patients continue to improve after treatment. And that's not a research finding we have with CBT. There's a wonderful meta-analysis Jonathan Shedler did on
Okay.
that.
We'll post that up for the listeners. Now, Tell us the difference between so the psychodynamic therapy and you're doing intensive short-term dynamic therapy. Because we usually typically think psychodynamic very long, years, twice a week or three times a week, working through age-old problems in your life, you know? What's the difference with that and what you're doing?
When we look at how long therapy takes, it really depends on the patient, right? I mean, no matter what kind of therapy you do, the length of therapy really depends on the severity of the problem. It's like, it'd be like saying if people, of course, insurance companies say every therapy should only be 20 sessions long. That'd be like an engineer saying that every bridge should be 20 feet long. No engineer would keep his job if he said something silly like that. Right. We have short bridges with the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, I think it's like 4 miles long or whatever. So obviously the more trouble the patient, the longer therapy is going to be. But that also means that some people can be treated in a very short period of time. So I like to think of ISDDP or intensive short-term dynamic psychotherapy as a very time-efficient model. So we have, I have some patients where I've seen them only a few times or I see them 10 sessions. Some people benefit from 20 sessions, but the more disturbed the patient is, yes, I might have to see a patient once a week for maybe 3 years if it's a really severe depression, or if, for instance, if someone has a borderline personality disorder, yeah, we're going to be looking at least 3 years of treatment with someone like that on a once a week basis. So the more severe disturbance, the longer it would take. I recently finished a treatment with a woman where I met with her once a month for a 2 or 3 hour session for I think 3 or 4 years. And when she entered, she was hearing voices. So obviously it took longer to help her with that. And she had a fantastic outcome. I think that's also important that when we think about how long therapy lasts, it's always important to keep in mind the more severe the disturbance, the longer the treatment will take.
You know, it is hard to standardize, and a session length or treatment length for people. Mm-hmm. What do you, going back to your point of relapse rates for CBT, and mm-hmm. I'm a CBT therapist, but yes, there are. It's challenges, and I think that it fits very nice. I think in maybe the modern day practices, especially in a health system, right? Because it's short, it's very focused, it does, and mm-hmm. very symptom specific often. But what do you think intensive short term dynamic therapy brings in that is relapse preventive as compared to CBT?
Right. Well, let's take a case. So the other day I was supervising a case, and the patient was suffering some anxiety and depression, and she was describing. I think she was wanting to go back to graduate school to pursue some sort of a degree, and apparently her parents were dubious of her, not sure it was a good idea, and disagreed, and so on. Okay. And the patient was naturally angry about this. And so from a dynamic point of view, we'd say, okay, so obviously she was angry. This anger makes anxious. How is she handling her anger, right? How is she is? And so then we'd be looking, rather than feel her anger, we notice that she covers her anger with self-doubt. Or rather than face her anger, she offers a lot of thoughts. Rather than face the anger, she turns anger toward her parents into self-criticism on herself. So we'd be looking at how can we help her face this anger toward her parents so she doesn't have to turn it on herself. How and then begin to look at how we could help her begin to look at her conflict. So for instance, the patient said, I just wish they would support me. Now, that's a very understandable wish. We wish that too. But when she says, I wish my parents supported me, we would call it denial through fantasy. Right. I'm going to relate to the fantasy parents I wish I had rather than the ones I've got. Well, that's really not going to help her because even though she wishes she had fantasy parents, which I wish she did too, she's got real parents and real feelings that she has to face. So we might address her defense this way. We might say, I wish your parents supported you too. But since they don't, shall we help you face the feelings toward them? You know, and she talked about how she lost her own point of view, or she'd lose her mind, or you know, let go. And she said, so what it makes sense for us to face this anger toward your parents so we can hold help you hold on to your ambition, even when your parents can't hold on to it for you? Would it make sense for us to help you face this anger here so you can hold on to your anger and use it for effective limit setting and boundaries with your parents? Would you like us to help you face this anger so you can hold on to your strength and assert yourself when there is a conflict with your parents? So in these ways, right, we're looking at her conflict and using the idea of conflict as a way to help her see, you know, the defenses she uses, that rather than face anger toward her parents, she lets go of her point of view, she goes to self-attack, she goes to, you know, or she'll say, they don't see my capacity. And I said, right, so would you like us to help you face this anger so you can hold on to your power and capacity when you're with your parents, right? So in these ways, we're helping her face her conflict, we're helping her see why we would take a look at these feelings, and it's very symptom focused, because we're showing how each defense is creating her symptoms. See, from our point of view, and as dynamic therapy, she has this anger toward parents she loves. That makes her anxious. That's not the problem. The problem is she has trouble dealing with her anger, so she turns it on herself. She lets go of her point of view. She lets go of her strength, her capacity. And so in that way, if we can show her how those defenses are creating her problems and symptoms, then it really it becomes clear to her that this truly is a symptom-focused treatment, and we want to help her with those defenses so she can hold, so that the positive goal is really to be able to hold on to her point of view, her strength, her power, when there is conflict.
So it is still symptom-focused, or I guess the problem the person is bringing into therapy, but it's deeper. It's kind of like going at a deeper level rather than, okay, you've got anxiety, let's just tackle anxiety, and without actually trying to figure out maybe what's leading to that anxiety.
Right, because in this case, anger towards someone she loves makes her anxious, and that's always going to be true for some degree. The question is, is she able to channel her anger into effective assertion, or is it getting channeled into self-criticism? Is it getting channeled into self-doubt? And so in that way, we can begin to help her see her conflict. Wow, of course you feel anxious when you're feeling anger toward parents you love. Can we take a look? But it sounds like then one way you're dealing with the anger is that the criticism comes back onto you. Could that be making you depressed? Right. Yeah. And when the anger gets turned on you in the form of self-doubt, could that be keeping you paralyzed, do you think? Mm-hmm. So she's beginning to see how the defenses create her problems, so that then together it makes sense that we want to look at the feelings, whatever the deep things are that the defenses are covering up. So if she says, oh gosh, I'm such an idiot, could that thought be hurting you? Could that be getting you depressed? Would it make sense to see what that thought might be covering up? Yeah, so if we look underneath that thought, you know, what feelings are coming up toward your parents? So that we're helping her look, let's see what's underneath the defenses. We can help her face what's underneath the defenses. If she can face what's under the defenses, she doesn't have to use defenses to ward off those feelings and urges and desires.
While you're talking, I mean, I want to just briefly explore before we wrap up. Defenses and the you know, this, the book that you wrote, Lies We Tell Ourselves. So when I was depressed, I was very disappointed, of course, with my friends, and I thought, here are a bunch of people who aren't supportive, look at them all, they absolutely suck. I mean, the height of my I think my anguish and anger and disappointment with them was me spending an hour complaining to a friend about friends. And, you know, the irony was not lost on me. But, you know, I realized that as I, you know, in my recovery and subsequent work, that yes, people will disappoint, but it doesn't mean that they're all bad. It means that they are not capable of carrying all my hope, right? They're not there to fulfill my fantasy that they will always be there and they would have no life. And, you know, every time we need someone to talk to, they're going to be there. But at the same time, even if they can't be that fantasy, it doesn't mean that they don't love me. It doesn't mean that they don't care, you know. So kind of coming to, I guess, a more realistic understanding of them, you know. So what's this, you know, the idea of lies we tell ourselves, is that one of the lies that we kind of have for people? We want them to fulfill our fantasies.
Yeah, all of us have a wish that a partner or friend would always want what we want or always satisfy our desires. And of course, we're going to be disappointed. And in that way, we'll feel angry toward people we love. And over time, we learn to accept that, that perfection is a fantasy, right? We learn to accept that people are real, and real is not the same as fantasy, and that there will be inevitable disappointments come up. And one of the things that's real is that when we're disappointed, we feel angry. That's not necessarily a problem that you're angry with when you're disappointed. I mean, you know, if someone doesn't drive right and they crash into your car, you're disappointed and you're angry. Why'd that knucklehead drive in my car? And that's not a problem. You're angry. The point is, because anger is also real. That's part of our life. It's part of being human, is to have emotion. So sometimes when we go into therapy, we hope somehow maybe I'll get purified and I wouldn't have any of these yucky emotions. Well, it's human to have emotions. We're just wired that way. Where we get into trouble is when we have trouble bearing our anger, and then we might turn it on ourselves and get depressed. Or, you know, when a friend's disappoints, we're angry with them, rather than just feel angry with our friends, we might turn it on ourselves, criticize ourselves, and get depressed. So in that way, we might have to help someone face their anger in the relationship as a way of facing, I'm angry with someone I love, and bearing the complex mixed feelings of any close relationship. But to be able to help them face that anger so they don't just automatically turn it on themselves and get depressed. See, even today, I was showing a video of someone, and this is a woman who'd been quite self-destructive. And at a certain point, as I was pointing out this, that, and she just stated that she was consciously trying to destroy her life. And at a certain point, I was asking about the feelings that were coming up toward me, because she said she was angry. And I said, yeah, and how do you experience that anger toward me? Oh God, I've got this pain in the back of my neck, she said. Somatization. Right. I said, wow, notice as soon as you feel this anger on me, it's like your body takes the hit. It's like the anger is toward me, but then it's your body that's suffering. You notice that? And then that would protect me. Yeah. So if you're just nice to your neck and let the anger come this way, yeah, can we see how you experience that anger? See, and then, and so far as we help her see that a few times, yeah, this patient won't have to experience somatic pain. She'll be able to feel her anger toward me or other people, but not to have to punish herself by having somatic pain in her neck. So that gives you another sense of helping her feel a little bit more deeply, so she doesn't have to have a symptom instead.
Do we need therapy to help us face reality? You know, could we try to do it ourselves?
I think the vast majority of people on this planet face reality without needing to go to a therapist. The vast majority of us. So it's just when we start to have psychological symptoms, it means like something's preventing me from being able to face reality. I need some help. But there are many people around the world that are facing reality and not suffering psychological symptoms. It's just when we're suffering psychological symptoms, it means there's something going on. I'm having trouble facing. I might not know what it is, but something's getting in my way.
Maybe it's the last question, you know, for our listeners who I think especially are struggling with, maybe on some level, they know what the reality is, but are having difficulty coming to terms with it. What do you think is a good first step for them?
What would be an example?
I'll take one from my life. I think often coming to terms with that people don't love me the way I want them to love me, or people don't care for me the way I want to be cared for, right? And it's so easy to then interpret it as they are unloving, or, you know, and kind of just shove them aside and reject them instead, right? Rather than come to terms that, okay, they're human as well and they're doing what they're doing to the best of their capabilities.
Exactly. Now, there's different ways to approach that. There's different ways to approach that. One response, a therapist might say to you, they might say, well, actually, it's not their job to love you your way. It's their job to love you their way. But it's actually your job to love you your way. And you're letting me know that rather than love you your way, you're asking other people to do that for you. So, do you need my help in helping you begin to love you your way? My wife can't love me my way because she's not me. But my wife can love me her way, which is very beautiful. And she can love me only her way because that's who she is. So in a way, if I was asking her to love me some other way or my way, I'd be asking her, don't be you, but I've got this job description for you. And let me tell you, this love job I have in mind for you. So in a way, I would be asking her to be sort of a love doll following my love instructions. Whereas my job really is, to let her love me her way. And if I want to be loved some other way, I should get to work, right? Because then it suggests, how am I failing to love me my way? In what way am I failing to be sufficiently kind and compassionate and loving to myself?
So instead of bringing the
So
focus to
it's
other people, it's almost like bringing the focus within and going, okay, what's going on here?
exactly. And also, it's just being very realistic. I mean, my wife should love me her way because she's her. She's not me. It's not her job to love me my way because she's not me. And so, in a way, it's also getting at the issue of differentiation, realizing my wife is not me. I would be saying, no, don't be you, be this other way, and then I'll really be happy. And she'd have to ask me, are you unable to love me, John? Are you asking me to be your fantasy wife that you could love? This is not making me feel so good, right? And then I'd have said, God, I'm actually not loving my wife. I'm asking her to be a fantasy wife that I could love. And then I'd have to say, oh, wow, that makes sense given my childhood. Where someone said, John, I can't love you this way, but if you be my fantasy son, then I think we've got something going here, right? So it's this really this fascinating thing of can we truly accept the other?
And then the other is not
And
me, and that's okay, right? To make space for the other to be
well,
themselves.
whether it's okay or not, it is what is. I mean, it's sort of like, is it okay that it's that there's gravity? Well,
Good point.
sure, go ahead, say it's okay. The world will be very grateful that you said gravity is okay. And it's sort of like it doesn't make any difference. It's just what is.
Well, gravity doesn't need our approval. It just exists.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, reality has never followed my instructions. So, yeah, apparently it's okay.
Thank you, John, for joining us, and I really had a delightful conversation with you.
Well, thanks so much for inviting me. It was a pure pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.